Welcome to the Flow Tracy Monitor Commentary. This is when Tracy recording. It's 3:24 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is June 12th. Well, oil prices were down $3 today, or just about, and that's coming right down to the lower side of the range. We can also see that on each of the occasions it's come down to this level, we've had a good sized rebound intra-week. So today's a Monday. It's got 4 days left to bounce and still have one of those similar tails on the candle. But of course, if we get downside follow through tomorrow, well, then this is a breakdown which extends the medium term downtrend. Now, there has been a lot of activity on the borders of this inert range. You've had OPEC cutting 1 million barrels off of supply. You have Germany that's in a recession, or at least has negative growth. You've got a pretty unimpressive rebound in economic activity in China, and then you've had a price environment which has been just very inert, where you've had a tight range between about $70 and $80, and it's probably a little bit tighter than that even. But the more important point is that the global economy is slowing down, and there's only so much supply can get taken out of the market voluntarily. And there's only so much pain a supplier is willing to take because they have their budgets to balance. So they obviously want to talk the market up by saying that they will take more supply out of the market, but the reality is that the entire global economy is suffering from interest rates that have been jumping higher. And that is having a knock-on effect on demand for oil. And then, of course, you have the raw way of analyzing commodities. And the bulk of analysis in commodity markets tends to focus on supply. People want to know the cost of production. They want to know how much will be produced. What's the cost of moving it around? All of that factors into the supply side. Whereas the demand side generally tends to be fairly predictable. It goes up in line with global economic growth, which is a couple of percent a year, more often than not. And when you only have one variable in an equation, it's a lot easier to solve than when you have two. And right now you have two variables because global demand is not as predictable. There are significant headwinds. One, of course, is the higher interest rate environment, and the second one is the attempts by governments and by lobbying groups to curtail demand. And those are very powerful themes. But of course, what it is also suggesting is that the global economy is slowing down. So this, I think, is particularly interesting because what we have right now is we're heading into the Fed meeting in the middle of this week, and the stock market is rallying into it. The 10-year yield on the U.S. Treasury is pretty much unchanged, but the Nasdaq was up 2% in here today. So that is a really quite clear break on the upside. Now, it was led higher by Broadcom. And Broadcom is benefiting because Apple is going to be buying more chips from them. That was the reason for the big breakout, and it's why the share remains quite firm. And then Airbnb has also continued to surprise on the upside. But what I think is perhaps more interesting at present, and at least Airbnb has base formation characteristics, and the company does have a reasonably viable future when lots of people are still talking about spending on travel. But I thought it was the activity that we saw on Intel today was perhaps the most interesting, where it has now clearly popped up through that 200-day moving average. Now, it's hard to imagine that Intel is going to be the kind of company that that people flock to because it has such a long history of disappointing. But that's a fairly well-defined base formation over the last 9 months. We have a higher reaction low, and it has now popped back above the $30 level and the 200-day moving average. So There's at least the potential that it could go back up and test the lower side of the overhead trading range, which is north of $40. So that's a fairly reasonable return over what could be a reasonably short period of time. But then the bigger question is, well, are they going to be able to continue to surprise with the results from the new chips that they release? And are they going to be in a competitive position relative to the real heavyweights? Nvidia, for example, has been the go-to share for the AI sector, and the share was in positive territory in here today. This little consolidation that's been underway now since the big gap higher, it has held so far. But I think rather than going through a full chart review of every single semiconductor company, I think it's suffice to say that most of them were in positive territory today. Now, that obviously comes with caveats. So the first is that the technology sector has been strong for a clear and simple reason. There's a lot of enthusiasm around artificial intelligence, and then the primacy of the technology sector's ability to do more with less, to be a deflationary force on the global economy. And obviously, then also its ability to create something out of nothing, which is the very essence of a productivity-led economic expansion. And then, of course, you have the other side of it, which is that interest rates have gone up a lot. A lot of the smaller companies cratered last year, and the better capitalized and bigger balance sheet type companies came through better. And they are now pricing in the potential that we are at the top of the interest rate hiking cycle, that the Federal Reserve will pause in raising interest rates this month, or this week, I should say, and that subsequently the number of interest rate hikes we could be at the peak, or if there is another, there's probably only going to be one more. And of course, if that is the case, and everyone understands now that these are long duration type companies where they can generate growth, and that growth is worth more in a lower interest rate environment, well, then the argument is that you should buy them now ahead of the interest rate cuts. Of course, that is leaving out one really big glaring part of the argument, which is that in a recessionary kind of environment, there won't be any hit to their earnings at all. Well, considering the valuations that some of these companies are trading on, then they cannot really tolerate any fall in their earnings. And of course, we will see what happens, particularly if this is an example of buying the rumor. We may see some sell the news coming through on Wednesday. Now, when we look around the world, I think what we're seeing in Japan is rather interesting. The Nikkei was in positive territory today, and this is a very clear breakout. And I have been a bit slow to buy Japan, but I think that's a big breakout. I really should have a position, so I bought some last night. And I think that it is a really quite profound move when we look at it over the very long term. Now, this is in US dollar terms, and it got up to test the peak from all the way back in 1989 in 2021 and pulled back. But then we look at it in local currencies, we are still well shy of the peak. But the most important thing is that you have this well-defined base formation. You had a first step above the base for the Nikkei in between 2017 and 2020. Then it popped on the upside and you get another range. Now it's popping on the upside once more. I think it is reasonable to conclude that if this is now a trending environment where we have a series of ranges, one above the last, and the amplitude of those ranges is in the order of about 5,000 points, then the next area of potential resistance could be somewhere around the 35,000 mark, and that subsequently 30,000 should be an area of support. And subsequently, we could get a range that could last for a few years. And that would be assuming that the trend is absolutely consistent. Now, why is it that Japan is doing so much better? Well, I think it is interesting to look at some of those companies, and we have Kobe Steel, for example. So that's one of Japan's big steel companies, and it has very clearly broken out of its range, and it is improving upon that performance. Mitsubishi, which is the obviously it's the parent company of Mitsubishi Heavy, as well as several other of the parts of the conglomerate, it is surging higher and has really been surging now for the last 6 weeks. So there's certainly a lot of interest in Japan. And of course, it begs the question, what exactly is going on? And one thing I thought was interesting is that CPI is moving higher, but that the PPI looks like it has peaked. In fact, PPI is coming back down into the underlying range. So that would suggest that it won't be too long before CPI also rolls over. Now, the euro yen is one of the more important currency pairs, because both Japan and the EU, or the Eurozone in particular, they compete for many of the same markets. In just the same way that Korean won, Japanese yen is also an important pair. And the euro is now right in the region of 150, and that's the upper side of this range that's been forming since 2009. And, or I guess from since 8, really, since it fell through the 150 level, there's been a sequence of higher major reaction lows since 2012. And now there's the potential that it could pop on the upside here. It does look better supported on this occasion than it was following that initial spike higher in 2014. Now we are getting a little consolidation in this area, and Japan is very eager to devalue their currency. And now the big question is, if global growth is slowing down and the German economy is contracting, will the Eurozone be as eager to allow the currency to appreciate as they have been during the pandemic and during an inflationary period? Because if inflation comes back under control, then that is going to give free rein to countries and central banks to devalue their currencies in an effort to boost competitiveness. So we are at a rather interesting juncture here. Japan has been doing all the running in trying to devalue their currency and sustaining their yield curve control program. And with inflationary pressures beginning to moderate there, then the chances of them abandoning the yield curve control program look to be fairly remote. So then it does beg the question whether we are now about to move into a competitive devaluation environment versus the kind of competitive appreciation environment we had during the pandemic. So we can then, I think, also look at the dollar index. And it was in mildly positive territory today, and it is holding here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And of course, it does also beg the question that if the technology sector in the USA is going to continue to perform, and it is still firing here. So on local currency terms or constant currency terms, the Nasdaq is still the best performing major market in the world. And the Nikkei is more or less in line with what we've seen in most of Europe and for the S&P 500. And then the Dow Jones is pretty much unchanged for the year. And of course, those are more the industrials, even though you have companies in there like Apple and Microsoft and Salesforce. And then on the very, what I would consider to be consumer staples side, which would be UnitedHealthcare, which is an insurance company, there aren't that many pure industrials, whereas Japan's market is much more industrially oriented, and so are Europe's. So there is also the potential that Japan will continue to prosper, not so much because there's going to be a big flood of Japanese money back into the domestic market, because I think that It's going to be a while before they abandon the yield curve control program, but I think instead it might be because foreign investment will go seeking value. And there are plenty of companies in Japan with a single digit multiple. So then a catalyst for growth could potentially be that we need greater manufacturing capacity ex-China. And that's beneficial for the industrial sector because it'll create more demand for their goods and services and products. So that could easily be one of the reasons why Japan is moving to a better position of outperformance. And then the Mexican market is also among the better performers, and it has broken out from this range that's been forming since 2015. But of course, there is still the potential that there will be a global recession and that eventually the US markets will roll over. But for the moment, at least, there's still a lot of liquidity around. And I think this is the most important point, that there is a great deal of liquidity floating around. And the central banks are worried about the impact that all of that liquidity is going to have on leverage, on consumers, and then, of course, the housing market, the home builders, continue to push higher from here. So I think that's a very clear breakout to new all-time highs, and it suggests that home builders are still in a strong position, that the economy is not yet contracting, and that demand for housing might have slowed down because we've had a big jump in interest rates, but it has not evaporated. And a lot of the reason for that is most people were able to lock in mortgages that are way below where interest rates are right now, and they would have to give those up if they sell. So that's obviously a mitigating factor in increasing supply. But there's a lot of apartments that are under construction right now, and they will come to market eventually. And that will at least ease some of the pressure on the rental market. Then the mortgage rate in the UK is problematic. It's exactly the opposite situation for large numbers of UK consumers, where they are now being rolled into much higher rates. So government bond yields continue to march higher. Now they're right back in the region of the peak from the teeth, really, of the pension crisis last year. And this continues to look like a consistent trend on the upside. So the higher yield overall has been one of the push factors in supporting the pound in the region of the 125 area. But as we look at a more uncertain environment, then potentially the dollar will get a bit more of a get some more support because people will be looking at what are the opportunities. And because the dollar is a little steadier, then gold was pretty much unchanged in here today. But I think that we can't really stay in an environment where we have high interest rates, where oil prices look like they're going to trend downwards, and which is a reflection of weaker economic activity, and then technology that is surging on the upside. Eventually, the bets come down to the trajectory for interest rates. And if they really are serious about getting in control of inflationary pressures, then they're going to have to hold interest rates higher for longer. If they decide to cut interest rates soon, as in the next 3 or 4 months, well, then that's going to be a clear admission that they value other factors more than getting inflation under control, and that will mean that there's a much greater potential that that inflation will become entrenched. And of course, that then would also be problematic because it will necessitate that there will have to be even tighter monetary conditions the next time around. And realistically, that is perhaps the most likely scenario, that they're not willing to take all the pain in one go. They might spread it out over a couple of cycles. And then what happens with China and their willingness to stimulate is probably going to have a big influence as well. Now, the renminbi continues to depreciate, and it's coming right back into the region of the lows around 720. Now, we have plenty of evidence that the Chinese central bank are willing to step in and support the currency at these levels. But there's no sign of it yet. And the reality here is that China needs to stimulate the economy, but they're terrified of reflating the property bubble. And property prices are still exceptionally high. So these are that's a real catch-22 from China's perspective. What it suggests is that they're going to continue doing what they have been doing, which is to provide targeted support as and when it is required or absolutely required, but that they are willing to allow the currency to take some of the brunt. And of course, what this is also suggesting is that we are moving back into a period of competitive currency devaluation. So Japan has been doing it. Now we have China devaluing their currency. And I think it is more likely than not that Europe is probably approaching the peak of the interest rate hiking cycle because they're not going to be able to tolerate a stronger euro. So that's also one of the reasons why the dollar is steadying up here. But then the much bigger point is that this is really not good news for getting inflation under control. And in an environment of competitive currency devaluation, then gold does become a more attractive asset. But we're probably going to need a bit of a catalyst in terms of a major devaluation in order to really reignite interest in gold. The consolidation that's underway has been very inert and quite tight relative to the volatility that gold is capable of. So I continue to think that the more likely scenario is gold will break on the upside, but not until we have an interest rate or a devaluation type catalyst to really drive that interest. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.